Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
There's no way of dressing it up. This is a story about cane toads. Originally from Brazil, they were introduced to the Queensland cane fields in the 1930s in the hope they would control nuisance bugs in the cane fields. It was a big mistake. But this is also a story about stewardship. Cane toads are extremely poisonous, and because they're not meant to be here, they don't play nice with our local ecosystem. They can have a disastrous impact on goannas, snakes, quolls, anything that likes eating frogs. But because of what scientists are discovering, we're learning to be better stewards, making good, if you like, for the mistakes of our forebears. And this is also a story about a possible change to the way we think about evolution. By studying cane toads, Dr. Rick Shine and his colleagues have proposed a new evolutionary process, one that Charles Darwin didn't know about. Now, Darwin suggested that we probably wouldn't see evolutionary change in the normal course of observation, as it's a very slow process. But Dr. Shine says it's different for invasive species like the cane toad. By comparing toads on different sides of the continent, effectively with Australia as his laboratory, Dr. Shine and his team have made some remarkable findings about how these toads, originally from Brazil, have changed over time to adapt and even thrive in Australian conditions.
Toads have had 80 years within Australia. They came in 1935. And if you look at toads from Queensland, where the toads were first introduced, compared to, say, the Kimberley in Western Australia, where the invasion front is now moving, the animals are different shapes, different physiology, different behaviour, a whole range of different things. Many of them related to the fact that the guys at the invasion front move very rapidly. They move huge distances, whereas the ones back in Queensland more or less sit around. Now, of course, that could be nurture rather than nature. I mean, that could simply be that conditions in the Kimberley make a toad grow up to be a wandering soul rather than a stay-at-home.
Yes.
But if you take the adult toads from Queensland and from Western Australia and you breed them and you raise the offspring under exactly identical conditions, the offspring end up looking and acting and having physiology of their parents. So it's heritable. It's definitely handed down in the genetics. Those toads are different, and by definition, they have evolved over the course of that 80 years.
So the Darwin theory is that these things develop because they're beneficial. Non-beneficial traits die out, whereas beneficial traits survive.
Yeah.
So the one that they've developed, I think, is quite fascinating, the ability to hop faster and in a straight line.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. If you grow up these baby toads and you release them in the same spot at the same time, and not only do the Western Australian toads move much further, but they keep moving in the same direction every night. And that means, of course, that they get to travel a lot further, whereas the Queenslanders don't move as far, and they change direction every evening. So, yeah, look, it's dramatic what's happened. It's about 80 generations. I mean, it's had time to do it. So, look, it could be natural selection. It could be that there has been a benefit to being at the front because there's less competition with other toads, and so genes that enable you to move a bit quicker have increased in frequency. But there's another thing that's happening as well that's a new kind of evolutionary process that Darwin didn't recognise, which we call spatial sorting, and it's simply that this is a foot race across a continent. You've got a fairly slow-moving animal. Toads are not, you know, not going to move as quickly as a bird does. And so you've had 80 years where they're spreading westwards, and in every generation, the fastest moving toads inevitably are the ones that end up at the invasion front. They breed with each other because the slowpokes have all been left behind. Genes for fast movement in mum and fast movement in dad end up getting combined in the offspring. So even if you don't get any selective advantage, you don't get any change in the relative numbers of fast genes and slow genes, you end up with all the fast genes concentrated in the guys at the invasion front. And that maybe really explain a large part of what's going on here, that it's actually evolution through space rather than time.
Oh, I really like the sound of it because it's so, it's easy to grasp, and you can even, I mean, I remember my boys played football. One of my children played football with a guy. Both of his parents were like Olympic runners or something, and he was the fastest kid on the team. And you just knew that he was going to be an absolute star. And he was certainly the fastest kid on the team. So you're saying in the toad world, the ones that are at the front of what you've called the invasion force, they're breeding with each other, their children grow up with the fast genes, they keep going. And
it increases generation after generation.
I see.
You know, you end up with any gene and mutation or whatever that arises that slows you down gets left behind. It can't stay up at the front. Any mutation that arises that makes you go a bit quicker, or simply the combination of genes for endurance from mum and for speed from dad, you end up with those, you know, within the same baby. I mean, some of the other babies will get slow genes from mum and dad and they won't go anywhere, but at least some of them will end up concentrating these genes for rapid movement, rapid dispersal.
Yeah.
And so you'll end up with a toad that's really different. You know, if you do behavioural tests on these guys, for example, the toads at the front are very bold, inquisitive, active animals. They're quite social. They look for other toads. It's hard to keep them in captivity. They sort of bump their nose against the glass. They want to get going, whereas the toads from Queensland, sitting in the same cage, are very happy to sit under their shelter and come out at night and eat a cockroach.
There it is. We've described both human and toad nature. I'm really quite sure of it. Now, tell me this, Professor Shine. Have you seen in your studies any evidence that a new species is developing? Because that's, for many people, of course, that's a bridge too far in terms of evolution.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, there are many different ways to define what a new species is.
Oh, right.
And most people would say that it's a new species when it gets to be sufficiently different genetically that it ends up having problems interbreeding with the original type. And it's unlikely, I think, that the toads have moved that far. I've actually got one of my postdocs is looking at that question. So, look, it's interesting how different you can be with even quite minor and genetic changes, but I don't think 80 years has been enough to give us a new species.
No. Well, you're aware that this is a program about life and faith. You also be aware that for some Christians, the theory of evolution is problematic, perhaps for reasons that are not well understood. I mean, what would you say to those who have just heard what you've been talking about and are either puzzled or challenged in their faith? Should, in other words, should people of faith be concerned about what you've observed?
No, I mean, I think it's entirely up to individuals to make the decisions about their own beliefs and so forth. I have no desire to tell people, you know, what they should believe. All I can say is that what we're looking at in the toads is a very simple process of evolution, where an animal is changing quite markedly, quite rapidly. I think the evidence that that's happened is absolutely overwhelming, the sort of stuff we've already talked about. Where you want to go from there in terms of its philosophical implications and so on is really an individual decision. Personally, I don't see any breakpoints. I see that process continuing on through time to give us the origin of species and so on and so forth. But if people wish to say, look, they can, you know, I think even most special creationists would be quite happy with the notion that natural selection adjusts organisms to the local conditions. It makes sense that organisms that function better in that place are the ones that are going to survive and reproduce. And that's really all that Darwin was saying.
But even if you were of a mind to, there's nothing in your work that would lead you to conclude that there was a God or there wasn't a God who was either the initiator and or the sustainer of the process, I presume.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems to me that the the evidence that we have at the moment says that once we have these original replicating life forms, then the process of natural selection can explain how we can get this extraordinary diversity, you know, from bananas to orangutans. I personally don't see a need to invoke any more complicated explanation than that. I think the evidence is overwhelming for me. But, you know, clearly, where did those first self-replicating molecules come from? What is matter? How did the universe come to be?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a bunch of questions back in there that we clearly do not have the answers to. And I guess if I was looking for a justification for a theological interference in the whole process of life, I'd be looking well back, because I think current biology has provided great detail to show that once you have these replicating organisms, then it's really pretty easy to see how they've given us the diversity of life today.
How very interesting. Well, one of the things I'll be asking God when I get to heaven is what was the cane toad all about? But but you've given me a reason to think that it's not quite as bad as I imagine. Now, look, the cane toad was brought here to do a specific job. It did that job pretty well, but it turns out it did other things even better, like reproduce and like kill off the sorts of things that we hold dear, like some of our native flora and fauna. So what is the evidence about the invasion of the cane toad and its impact on our native flora and fauna in the 21st century?
Yes, well, it's a sad story. You know, there was very little real attempt to look at what the problems might be, and you know, they brought it in to eat the insects that were eating commercial sugarcane. It wasn't very good at that, but it spread quicker and quicker through Australia, and initially moving at about 10 kilometres a year in the 1940s. Now it's about 60 kilometres a year because of the evolution of these dispersal characteristics. The problem is that we don't have any native species of toads in Australia, and toads as a group occur in most of the rest of the world, and they have a very distinctive kind of chemical defence, a poison that they keep in their shoulder glands and a few other places in their body, which is capable of giving a predator an almost instantaneous heart attack, a fatal heart attack. So if you evolve in a country where there are native toads, you may well be resistant to that poison. A few small genetic changes make you about 30,000 times more resistant to the poison.
Are we seeing any of that now in the species that have been interacting with cane toads for, 80 years?
Yeah, well, we haven't seen the evolution of resistance. We've seen the evolution of an ability not to eat cane toads, to recognise that they're not suitable food.
Right, so a behavioural characteristic.
Yeah, and so we've got, I think, clear evidence, particularly with some of the snakes, that the snakes that are in areas that now contain toads, that were knocked back, that are now recovering, the snakes that you find simply refuse to eat a cane toad when you offer it to them. But there are a bunch of Australian species of predators that are quite capable of dealing with cane toads as well. So the rats, the mice, the native ones as well as the domestic ones, they can eat toads all day, and in fact they love them. They'll come back for more.
Really?
Many insects will eat the toad tadpoles or even the small toads. The big meat ants kill millions of baby toads every year. So birds in general are not affected by the poison, and they seem to be able to detect it, so they don't eat the bits of the toad that contain the poison. Mm-hmm. And so we've actually got quite a few native Australian predators that benefit. When the toad comes into town, there's an extra food source. But if you're a goanna or one of the big venomous snakes, a freshwater crocodile in some areas, a marsupial quoll, we have about 95% mortality of those big predators when the toads first arrive.
Goodness
so
me.
It's an ecological catastrophe, but for a small number of species.
And over a short space of time?
If you go to places where toads have been present for 80 years in Queensland, those vulnerable predators that crashed seem to have come back to a reasonable degree.
Right.
And things like goannas and quolls are really quite common around Cairns, and they coexist with toads. They know not to eat them, and they're perfectly fine living with them.
So would you say that we shouldn't be concerned, or that we should be concerned? How much effort do we need to put into cane toad eradication programs now?
Well, toads cause a variety of problems, and I think the system would be better off without them. I think it is worth looking into ways to control them, and we're doing that, and we've found some ways that are working pretty well. The biggest impact by far is at the invasion front. When those predators first encounter toads, the problem is the big predators, because they try to eat big toads, and they're the ones with enough poison to kill you.
Yeah.
What we've shown is that if you expose those predators to small toads first, they learn not to eat toads, and so they ignore the big ones when they arrive. And so we can actually keep goannas and quolls and so on in the system with a simple education program. We provide small toads or sausages that taste like cane toads.
Sorry, wait a minute. You said sausages.
Yeah, indeed. Yes, we can make...
You make cane toad sausages?
Out of toad flesh. And we can add a little chemical that will make the predator quite nauseous but won't kill it. And so quolls and goannas and blue-tongued lizards that encounter those sausages or encounter a small toad that we might release just in advance of the main front, will learn that cane toads are a bad dietary item, and we've shown very clearly with very controlled studies and all this sort of thing that the survival of the predators goes up dramatically if you give them that learning experience. And so we're actually doing that now across the Kimberley. We've got a variety of partners, the Department of Parks and Wildlife and a bunch of private groups and so on, and we're actually educating predators as the toad front rolls through in the hope of creating these pockets of resistant predators. As long as the predators survive for that first year or two, their offspring are okay, because by the time their offspring are born, the toads have started to breed. There's lots of small toads around, lots of chances for that baby goanna to meet a small toad rather than a big one, and so learn for itself. So it's just this window of death, just a year or two at the front. And if we can buffer that impact, then we can keep predators around in perpetuity.
What a great story. Well, Professor Shine, thank you for unlocking the world of the toad. And just one last question. Are these cane toad sausages, are they better with tomato sauce or barbecue sauce?
I would think it would be a memorable meal, but in all the wrong ways.